Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Quick note that we will kick off all episodes with moving forward. This expanded coverage, aka 3 to 4 episodes a week, especially with the discussion episodes, is brought to you by the folks who have supported The Realignment's Supercast subscription. If you want to help support the show, help us increase content, support our staff, all those good things, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. You could also go in the show notes, which are in the description of every episode, and subscribe there too. So once again, realignment.supercast.com, $5 a month, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime subscription to support all the work we're doing right now. So huge. Also, if you want to learn more about what we're doing and our plans, you could go check our Substack, which is also linked in the show notes as well. On to today's actual episode. I'm speaking with Michael Kazin of Georgetown University. He's the author of a couple books that are really relevant to the show. Recently, he released What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. He's previously written The Populist Persuasion, An American History, and also A Relevance to Folks, American Dreamers, How the Left Changed the Nation. This episode is a follow-up to our conversation with Matthew Continetti a few weeks ago. His book was titled The Right, The 100-Year War for the Future of Conservatism. So this episode is basically looking at these realignment issues through the lens of the left and the Democratic Party in contrast to Continetti's episode on the right. So listen to these two back-to-back, listen to them together. I hope you really understand how things are going. All that said, huge thank you to LinkedIn for supporting our work. Hope you enjoy this episode. Michael Kazin, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be here, Marshall.
We're going to start this episode off with something our left-leaning audience has demanded of me: the proper definition and uses of terms like liberal, progressive, leftist, center-left. I often use these terms somewhat interchangeably and people get very mad. So you, as a historian of the left, can provide us with the final word on what these terms mean. So I just want to kind of go down the line, and then that will transition us into the conversation about how these various groupings and ideologies fit within the Democratic Party. So let's just start with leftist. Like, what is a leftist in the American political context?
Well, of course, you know, as a historian, I understand that way these terms have been used historically keeps changing all the time. Left, when I was growing up, used to be different from liberal. I was a leftist in college in the late 1960s. I hated liberals. They were the party of the Vietnam War. They were the party that opposed Black Power. You know, I was a new leftist. I didn't like liberals. I wanted to overthrow them and make a revolution. You know, now I think for conservatives, left means pretty much everyone in the Democratic Party, except maybe Joe Manchin. So the term has become more inclusive, I think, over time. Most Democrats now like to call themselves progressive, which the term that used to be associated with Teddy Roosevelt 100 years ago, and then became associated with communists in the 1930s. They had progressive bookshops. In 1948, they helped to run a third party candidacy by Henry Wallace, the former vice president, which was opposed to the Cold War, which was wanted the alliance with the Soviet Union to continue, the World War II alliance to continue. So these terms are very fungible. So it's really hard to say. I think most people now would talk about the left. And this includes, you know, people on the left would talk about the left as a large group of progressives within the Democratic Party. For me, what matters less than the term is what you mean by the term. But we need a term. I generally use progressive now just because that's a term that's out there and people seem to know what that means. I wish we could still use it left and liberal, because I think there's a key difference between people like AOC, like Bernie Sanders, like people in Democratic Socialists of America, who call themselves socialists, but some of whom, of course, are now congresspeople, right? There are four members of DSA who are congresspeople. To call them liberals, then what's Nancy Pelosi? You know, it's not the same. So I wish we could retain That difference from my youth, you know. Liberal are people who want to uphold the system, who think the system has some basic problems, but basically it's a good system, just needs reforms to change it. And those who are basically radicals, one way or another, think the system needs a pretty basic overhaul. Whether that means a socialist, democratic socialist system, or whether it means just a radically different system of economic redistribution, corporate regulation, the Green New Deal, and so forth. But we're pretty much stuck with progressive, I'm afraid, for the foreseeable future, like it or not.
You know, I like your use of the word radical in terms of today's context, because if, you know, I'm doing a bit of reading about the 60s and 70s and like leftist movements, and to me, that seems truly radical. If you read the pamphlets and the statements talking about like challenging empire and reconstructing, like the very, like, I don't need to tell you history that you live. This is more for the audience, obviously. But today, the Green New Deal is ambitious, but especially the way it's framed, it doesn't feel as radical. Medicare for All, by its very definition, isn't radical. It's saying, hey, there's this system, Medicare, people tend to like it, let's expand it. So what does the term radical mean in terms of these debates between liberals slash the center left and more progressive minded people?
Well, for most people, radical is either a cultural term, you know, something's rad, it's not rad. I'm not sure that term is still being used. I'm in my 70s, so I don't really know what people your age are saying, but
it's been a while since I heard rad.
Some of my students, you know, tell me, but, you know, radical obviously means go to the root. Radix is the Latin root of the term. And those who are radical want to go to the roots of what they think is wrong in society and tear them out, you know, and set down new roots. I think that's the most literal way to put it. I think, you know, some of the ideas certainly of the most left-wing people in the Democratic Party and outside the Democratic Party are pretty radical. I mean, they would, if all their ideas were carried out, all the Green New Deal ideas, a lot more public housing, cutting the defense budget, you know, pretty radically, you'd end up with a social democratic system, which would be actually beyond that, more left, more egalitarian than the social democratic systems, even in places like Scandinavia now, which is, you know, sort of known as the homeland of successful social democracy. So, in the American context, where we've never had any of these things, where the most radical, most left programs were passed in the 1930s and the 1960s, and the ideas of people on the far left of the Democratic Party would go beyond that, that would be radical. I mean, again, it all depends on context. I mean, that's a problem being a historian, you know. I'm not a political philosopher. I think what's radical in one period is not radical in another period. I mean, radical Reconstruction, for example, after the Civil War, it was radical because the aim was, you know, to make sure all African-American men would have the right to vote. You know, that's not radical anymore, but at the time it was quite radical.
So I'd love for you to, and this is a very basic open-ended question, but just talk about the Democratic Party. And it's just basic. This is way too broad of a question, so I'll reframe it a bit. The Democratic Party is the oldest political party in the world that's still functioning, obviously. And this is an interesting time to talk about political parties, because on the one hand, if you talk to a liberal, a progressive, left-leaning person in this audience, they will tell you the Democratic Party has all of its power. The DNC imposes its will. It prevents Bernie from winning. The establishment coordinates itself. But from a political party history perspective, the Democratic Party is incredibly weak. It's not able to enforce its will on Joe Manchin, shall we say. There's no such thing as the, you know, DNC doing the LBJ treatment to a recalcitrant senator like Kyrsten Sinema. So can you just talk about how we should conceive of the Democratic Party relative to its various degrees of power? Unpower is not a proper word, but that's what I'm kind of getting at.
Sure. It's a great question and really the essential question. And I think people who think the Democratic Party is weak, you know, aren't thinking about how parties become strong. Parties become strong in a two-party system, which is one we've pretty much always had since the beginning of mass parties in this country, because they're broad coalitions. This is a big country. Even when only white men could vote, it was still, you know, a pretty diverse country, ethnically and regionally, economically, occupationally. And Democrats, when they've been a strong party, were a diverse party. I mentioned in the book, What It Takes to Win, that the Democrats were the majority party in this country from the late 1820s up until the mid 1850s, and then from the 1930s up until through the 1960s. Pretty, you know, about 60 years altogether out of 200 years. And why were the majority party? Because they put together groups that didn't like each other very much and had some important differences, but had enough that united them that could stay in the same party. You know, you had Southern slave owners and Irish immigrants who came over here from the famine in the 1840s and 50s with only the clothes on their back in before the Civil War. In the 1930s and 40s, during the New Deal, Democrats had huge majorities. You had vicious Southern racists and anti-Semites, and you had communists and socialists who were supporting Democrats and sometimes even running as Democrats, as socialists are often today. But they unite on, all sides wanted the government to do more for ordinary people, however they define those ordinary people. And the labor movement in the 1930s and 40s was growing and was also a major force, especially in the North, Northern states and Western states, in pushing back against the racist wing of the party. But Democrats now are, it's true, a party which has too many, you know, bureaucratic organizations at the top, too many consultants, perhaps. But of course, Republicans are no different in that sense. But again, with narrow majorities like the Democrats have now, with, you know, not any votes to spare in the Senate and only a few votes to spare in the House, very hard to pass really far-reaching programs. That's never happened in American history for either party. Even when the Republicans were doing very well in the 1980s, they didn't do a lot what conservative Republicans wanted to do. You know, the Reagan Revolution didn't do very much, really. It basically stopped further reforms more than it rolled back programs that were passed during the Great Society days. So I think it's naive to think that just because the Democrats, you know, can pass anything they want, if every Democrat gets together and the filibuster is voted out, which is not going to happen, obviously, you know, that they're a weak party. They are still a broad coalition. And but the problem they have, as we know, is that the sort of, you know, white working class and more Latino working class, too, is beginning to, well, white working class is much more Republican now. Latino working class, too, judging from the last election, 2020, is beginning to move away from Democrats well. So in terms of the constituencies, it's a problem, become a majority party. But to imagine the Democrats as a solely progressive party, which I would like it to be. I'm on the left, so believe me, I'd like it to be. But you have to understand why it's not that right now, why historical forces have made it very difficult for progressives to triumph entirely. And so to say, well, Democrats have majorities, so they should be able to force Joe Manchin to do what they want. What they want. Joe Manchin is very popular in West Virginia, you know, where Donald Trump won twice by over 40% of the popular vote. So no other Democrat could get elected in West Virginia but Joe Manchin. So again, you know, Joe Manchin is king, or let's say Duke or something, because Democrats need him to get judges through, if nothing else.
You know, it's interesting, even your use of the term phrase majority, I think it gets to the core of what a lot of the debate about radicalism comes to, because, you know, let me just put on my like total progressive reformer hat. These aren't my politics, but I think I could echo them effectively. Democrats have won 7 out of 8 popular votes in this country, going back since the 1980s. If you add up the populations of the states, Democrats obviously have a very, very, very big majority. If you admit Puerto Rico and DC to give them, you know, senators and states, you would not have to worry about Joe Manchin as much. So can you just talk about this real contradiction between, because for context, we just recorded an episode with Andrew Yang's former campaign manager. And he said, you know, it's really tough because Democrats, they just can't do anything. They just can't win. And I was thinking, well, technically speaking, popular vote, Democrats are winning. If you take every single American citizen, Puerto Ricans, people from Guam, you know, people in DC, Democrats are winning. So can you speak to this? Because I think this is something which, as a centrist person, I have a hard time responding to people who push from the left to make this critique.
Well, as you know, Marshall, we have this strange system that was set up almost 250 years ago, which in its basic structure has not changed that much. I mean, it's changed in terms of, you know, who can vote, of course, that's important, obviously, essential. But it's still a federal system And, you know, Wyoming still has the same number of senators as California. And we still have a Supreme Court, which, of course, under the Constitution didn't have a judicial review. But pretty soon after the country was founded, it got judicial review. And now that's, you know, people accept it, whether they like it or not. So it's not a fully democratic system. Never has been, was not intended to be. So that's part of the problem, I think. And to change that, you'd need to change the entire system. So that's not going to happen anytime soon. So the only way to around it is for Democrats to win state elections and state legislatures, which they used to do. Again, when Democrats were the majority party, they could do that. I mean, until recently, Democrats had elected senators in North Dakota and Missouri, and they still have a senator from Montana. They elect a senator from Alaska. So there are places where Democrats used to do well, even when Republican presidential candidates won those electoral votes. But you know, Democrats have, I think, some progressives who understand this, I think, are right to make the critique that Democrats stopped making an appeal to, you might say, centrist voters. I'd say mostly non-college educated voters in red and purple states. And I think, you know, the way they have to appeal to those people, and this is the argument in my book, is with universal economic programs, which will help those people, you know, which will help the large majority of Americans. That's the only way Democrats ever, you know, became the majority party. And I think it's the only way Democrats will, in any kind of secure way, be the majority party again. So that's my answer to that question. We're not going to change the structure of the Senate. You know, people look in the Constitution, you know, these little books here, Article 5, the last sentence of the Constitution, Article 5 of the Constitution. You can't change the makeup of the Senate unless the state that you want to change agrees. You know, that's not the language I'm paraphrasing. So Wyoming is not going to say, oh, that's fine. We have so few people. You know, let California have 10 senators. We'll just keep our two, you know, or don't give us any because we're too small. You know, not going to happen. So.
What do you think of the pushback that the reason why Democrats aren't performing well in rural states isn't broad economic policy, it's cultural issues. It's the Democratic Party has gone too, and once again, this is where the audience gets mad,
sure,
went too far to the left on social policy questions when, like, I'm using the word left more in the sense that a Republican would use the word left.
You know, I think it's a mixture. I think on the one hand, if Democrats aren't out there making a clear, strong, attractive pitch for universal economic programs and aren't making it clear that that's what they stand for above all. And despite Build Back Better, which of course didn't pass, I don't think that got to people. I don't think people understood what was in that program. And it was too complicated, too full of all kinds of things to make that argument, I think. Then the cultural issues, which are always there. We've never not had cultural issues that matter. Used to be religion really mattered, prohibition. Obviously, racial issues still matter tremendously. So all those issues matter, but they can be separated, you know, more easily, I think, when people don't see anything else, you know, that the Democrats are talking about coming to them. And, you know, when Democrats are known primarily, I say, as the party of, you know, racial justice, of LGBTQ rights, for example, which, again, I'm all for, but if that's the primary message that people in these states, mostly white people, non-college educated, are getting, then it's not surprising they say, so what's there for us, you know? What does the Democratic Party want to do for me, you know? Is it just trying to make me feel guilty, you know? And again, I'm not sympathetic to that argument, but then I'm not those people either. And as a historian, I try to be empathetic. I try to understand why people think what they think, rather than in the present as well. And that's what good politicians always do, of course, when they win. So I think that's the problem. Democrats have to balance those two. They have to sort of say, look, we have to be unified about these programs which can appeal to the large majority of people, because we're a democracy. You only win if you get the majority, right? And obviously state majorities, electoral college and Senate, as well as popular vote majorities. And so that would be my answer to people who make that argument.
You know, and it's interesting, and that's why your framing of the Democratic Party as a coalition is just so useful, because it helps you think about how this actually functions. So, for example, during this height of like the last Democratic majority, you know, 60s period, where you get so much legislation that people to the left obviously support now, that was a Democratic Party that had segregationists in it. Joe Biden gets in trouble for like essentially like and very directly saying this point about providing proper context. That's also a Democratic Party that, you know, Roe v. Wade had not been decided by then, but almost certainly would have featured much more pro-life people in the terms we use it today than the Democratic Party of today is. So how do you think about how those coalitions work if these work when it comes to those social issues?
Well, I mean, people have to agree to disagree, you know, to a certain extent. Look, I would not be, and this is be controversial, I would not be unhappy if the Democrats said to pro-life people, you can join the party, you can't decide on our position. Our position is still going to be, you know, that, you know, it's a woman's body, it's her right to choose, but we're not opposed to you being part of the party. And look, the pro-life movement used to be dominated by Catholics until the late 1970s. It was pretty much a Catholic movement. And most of those people were Democrats, actually, because Catholics traditionally were much more Democrats. Again, I'm not a political strategist, Marshall, so I don't want to say, okay, let me tell you, this is how you run the campaign in Pennsylvania. My son is a Democratic Party operative. So that's his job, but that's not my job. I do think that Democrats have to be willing to not get on Twitter and denounce each other, you know, on a regular basis. They have to be willing to agree to disagree on some issues, as long as they agree on, you know, the really big issues. And, you know, once it's Democratic Party policy, which it has been for many years, to support Roe v. Wade, you can have some a minority of pro-life people in the party. I don't think that's going to be a problem, you know, it depends on the issue we're talking about as well. Litmus test, I think, for a candidate is a mistake. You want candidates who can win as long as those candidates are not going to undermine, you know, the majority of the party. I mean, one of the things I'm impressed by, again, I don't want to be a Pollyanna here, but Democrats have done some things right, even since Joe Biden's been president, believe it or not. And one of them is that they've kept the House majority together. I mean, think, you know, there's the Democrats' House majority is very slim, I think 6 seats or something. You know, Republicans have to win back this fall to take control, something like that. But Nancy Pelosi has been able to keep that majority together. They've passed almost everything that the leadership wanted to pass, that Joe Biden wanted passed, that progressive support. But of course, they couldn't get it through the Senate. But people forget that House majority is pretty diverse, you know, and there are pro-life people in that majority as well, who voted for all these bills. So in some ways, that's a sign that Democrats can unite. You know, they just can't, you know, unite enough because they haven't got enough senators.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about, you know, the Democratic Party's position is going to be that, you know, we believe in a woman's right to choose. But thinking of the Republican Party didn't even have a party platform in 2020. The Republican Party really zoomed the 2020 election choice down to, do you like Donald Trump? Yay or nay? If you like Donald Trump, vote with us. It didn't win, but it got them 10 million more votes than they got in 2016. So how do you think about this idea of parties needing, in a very polarized age, parties needing to even have these like very specific, the Democratic Party doesn't endorse Obamacare, it endorses Medicare for all of this very specific, like, how do you just think about that dynamic?
Yeah, again, you know, it's a little bit question more for strategists than for a historian, but I'm happy to answer it.
Feel free to answer from a historical perspective too, of course.
First of all, you know, the issue, to speak as a historian here, the issue of platforms is interesting. Platforms used to really matter, you know. Newspapers used to publish them on their front pages, even when they were long. Usually they weren't that long, but, and candidates used to really run on them. You say, I'm, according to my platform, you know, this is what I'm for. I'm going to, you know, support it 100%. But now, you know, Democratic platform, I think last time was 80 pages, something like 90 pages, something like that. As you said, the Republicans didn't have one. Did anybody really care on either side? No, They didn't. But parties have to be known for the big issues they care most about. Democrats used to, in Andrew Jackson, when he was in his heyday, they cared about being against the big financial interests, the money power, as they called it, the second bank in the United States, which he vetoed the recharter of in the 1830s. They also cared a lot about expanding the borders of the country, you know, pushing back Native Americans, of course. And those are really the big issues. And in the South, you know, supporting slavery as well was a big issue. And 1930s and 40s, they cared about unions. They cared about creating jobs during the Great Depression. And then, of course, they cared about defeating fascism. In the 1960s, they cared about Medicare. They cared about expanding aid to education. They cared about civil rights and voting rights. And then became kind of caring about women's rights and LGBT rights as well. And then environmental. But the environmentalism was more, both parties supported that pretty much till the 1980s. So again, what was that, a minute? I summarized it. That, you know, it didn't take that long, right? But people have to be able to say, ah, I know the Democrats are for it. They're for this, this, and this. I'm for those things, or I'm not for those things. Republicans were very good at that in the Reagan era, for example. Everyone knew they were for, you know, family values, a strong defense, and limited domestic programs. That's it, right? That said it. Now, if you ask people, what are Democrats for? I'm not sure what they'd say. You know, it'd be interesting to have a poll on that. But so that's a problem.
And I think the part that's hard here is, even if you were to ask people, what are Democrats for? That framing would probably not be the one that Democrats would want. If someone were to say, like, well, Democrats are for, because if you're, I could see a Democrat saying, no, like, the entirety of my politics is not like fighting culture war issues. But I think for a lot of people, I think that's a perception there. So I think my next question then would be is, how can you, you know, once again, like, you're an historian of the left, I'd love for you just to talk through, you could have more than a minute to do this because it's a broad question. 2015, basically, to the present day, from the perspective of a left that saw an opportunity to fill a space that I think Donald Trump filled on the right, but Bernie tried to fill on the left. So just how did the left really respond to like the end of the second Obama administration and just like this broad period where it seems like so much is up for debate in the country right now?
Yeah, well, actually, I wrote an article about this for an anthology about the Obama presidency, and I think it's still true. You know, the left really did quite well under Obama.
That's counterintuitive.
Well, but I mean, think about it. Much bigger left now than there was in 2008. And that's not just, I mean, part of it was the Great Recession in some ways. I mean, basically 2008 to maybe 2020 was sort of the young left's 1960s, I think, in many ways. There was Occupy, there was Black Lives Matter. There was a lot of, you know, more support for something that we now call the Green New Deal, but a lot of environmental, a lot of gun rights marches. So that's pretty much subsided by now, unfortunately. Maybe it'll come back again after the horror in Buffalo. We'll see, but probably not. The court, you know, ruled for marriage equality. DSA grew from a tiny sect to close to 100,000 members. And key was Bernie Sanders' campaign, which of course I think was riding that wave that begins with the Great Recession. And the Obama, at least the hope of the Obama presidency, which most leftists supported. I noted that the left was more united behind Obama's campaign in 2008 than the left had ever been united around any Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, when he won, you know, a huge reelection campaign. And also a key thing was that Bernie Sanders ran as a Democrat. I mean, that was absolutely crucial, because, you know, the left throughout American history has fooled around with third parties. Sometimes those parties had some important impacts, like the People's Party did in the 1890s, the Socialist Party in some ways did in the early 20th century as well. Even the communists were important in the Black Freedom Movement and in the labor movement in the 1930s, 1940s. But electorally, those were dead ends, clearly. And so the only way leftists are ever going to have a real impact on electoral politics in any kind of ongoing way is to be part of a existing party. And the fact that Bruni ran as a Democrat encouraged other people to join him, encouraged groups like Progressive Democrats, Justice Democrats, to get behind left-wing primary challengers in various races, like AOC famously and many others, was crucial because the only way you're going to be able to ever going to be able to sort of push what Michael Harrington, the famous Democratic socialist, called the left wing of the possible, is to be part of a major political party, which makes left wing dreams, at least some of them, maybe possible. Because otherwise, you know, because you got to win elections to make sure those dreams can have a chance of being carried out. So that to me was absolutely critical. And the fact that the left is now, you know, unhappy with the Democratic Party, I remember a time when people who called themselves leftists thought there was no difference between the parties, didn't expect Democrats to do anything anyway. So
2000, what's the point? 2000 is calling if it's, yeah, that's actually, could you actually speak about that for, because like, once again, I was in third grade. So this is just me watching the NewsHour with my parents. So like, insert how much I knew as a third grader, but I just remember hearing from like other kids in like third grade whose parents were also politically active, just this, like, there is no difference between the two parties. Is that, and this is kind of what Jill Stein tried still using fumes of in 2016, but it really feels like a result of the polarization of the country has been, what are you smoking if you claim that these two parties, whether you like it or not, are the same at all? I mean, were they, ooh, this is interesting then. Was there validity to the claim in 2000?
That the two parties were the same? No, I don't think there was. I mean, there was more validity. You know, if you really want to have a hard time, if you have a hard time going to sleep sometime, Marshall, watch the debates in 2000 between Bush and Gore, you know, where they're arguing about the lockbox, you know, you've probably read about that and so forth. You know, there didn't seem to be big differences between them. Obviously, Clinton and Gore administration was a very centrist administration, though culturally, actually, it was more left, you know, on abortion, for example. But obviously, economically, it was a neoliberal, you know, administration, as most people would argue today. And George W. Bush tried to be a compassionate conservative. So, you know, there was a certain, but even then, labor supported the Democrats for good reasons, because the Democrats were still a more pro-labor party. And Bush was clearly a candidate of the Christian right. So he was not going to budge on gay rights or abortion. So even then, there were differences. But those differences, I think, have grown, in part because the left in the Democratic Party has been a force. You know, the Progressive Coalition has what, 110 members now or something? That's large. Now, not all those people are leftists. You know, some join because it looks good to say you're progressive, but even that is a what's the old term? Imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. You know, so Hakeem Jeffries, I think, who's not a real leftist, but he's a member of the Progressive Coalition because he wants to be, you know, Speaker of the House, and it makes sense to be seen as progressive. So, you know, I think it's true that Democrats have sometimes have been more to the right. Republicans have sometimes been more centrist than they are now. But those periods historically are pretty brief, usually.
Another way to ask a version of this question then is, and once again, I'm just channeling YouTube comment and email frustrations. Why does it feel as if AOC and these progressive members cannot drive internal party dynamics the way that right-wing Tea Party and Freedom Caucus members can? Because like once I, you know, I came up on the, you know, young right in DC, and I can just empirically tell you that it seems as if those Freedom Caucus members drove much more of the dynamic in the Republican Party than the progressives do on the Democratic side. So I'm very sympathetic to the frustration of this critique. Like, how do you think about that critique?
Well, again, I mean, you know this better than I do because you were part of that group. But I got the sense that, you know, people in the Tea Party were basically channeling the frustrations of majority Republicans.
Thank you. That's the correct answer. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I got it right. All right. Ask me another easy one. whereas the problem with Democrats is they are this broad coalition. You know, Republicans are not as broad a coalition. obviously they're broader than just, white Christian party. You know, if you were Republican, that, you know, partly explains it, but illustrates it. But they are mostly a white Christian party, right? And they obviously a party mostly of much more of rural states than more urban states and so forth. Whereas Democrats are a broader party, and also being a broader party regionally and also ideologically, means that, a left which is strong in metropolitan areas and close in suburbs and among college educated voters more and more, it's just not going to be able to drive, what happens in the whole party. You're not going to win election in Arkansas as a Democrat, by having AOC's politics. You're just not going to. But if you were a conservative Democrat, you're not going to win an AOC's district either. So, that's, again, why you've got to be a big tent, I think, focusing on issues which unite people. I don't want to keep repeating myself, but it's the message of my book, so why not? James Carville was right when he said in 1992, it's the economy stupid. It isn't always the economy stupid. The coastal issues do matter, but usually not for the national election. They matter more locally at different times. And wars matter too, of course, when the U.S. is in a war. The economy was in pretty good shape in 68, but it didn't matter because Hubert Humphrey was not going to win anyway, because the war was a big issue. But usually economic issues and what people think about economic issues, not just how they're feeling themselves, but how they think the economy is doing. That's why Democrats are going to lose this fall, most likely, because of inflation, even though unemployment's low. Most people obviously America's not hungry like they were in the Great Depression, but they're unhappy about the economy. And that in the end is what really matters.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to throw you up a softball with that party dynamics question, but this matters because if you think about these things as coalitions, the reality was GOP leadership in 2013 was out of step with a huge percentage of the Republican Party's base. GOP leadership thought their number one job after Obama's reelection was passing immigration reform. Right. Turned out that wasn't true, and Eric Cantor lost his political career because of that gap. The problem facing progressive leftists, and once again, this is not a criticism, it's not a policy, it's just like a dynamic, is they are actually the ones who are a little out of step with, let's say, the average person voting in a Democratic Party primary, especially across the country. So what they are trying to do is something different. They are trying to push the party to the left versus what a right insurgent is doing right now is say, hey, let's get you the leadership closer to the way people actually feel. So it's that just seems to be the central difference between the two parties. And it's also why, Nina Turner saying like voting for a Democrat is like, eating a bowl of crap. It doesn't play the same way it plays on the Republican Party side. So it's just such an important dynamic that really when I think a lot of leftists are jealous of the dynamics of the Republican Party, and they try to basically say our situation is similar when it's just not similar at all.
No, true. Look, Republicans have their problems too, obviously. As we saw, they have one problem is they have a former president who thinks he was still elected president and who's making it all about him. That's one problem. The other problem, I think, is they are standing for issues that in the short run might help them, but long run, I don't think are going to help them. Because I don't think in the end, especially most young people, most young voters are really gonna care about, or might even oppose, some of the culture war issues that Republicans are fighting on about gender and about race. So, I think Republicans too have to deliver, for people. And even when, Trump was popular, he wasn't that popular, but was more popular, they weren't really delivering. They were delivering tax reform for richer Americans, primarily, tax cuts. That's not there. Now, the problem Democrats have is, there's groups like Data for Progress, progressive polling groups, which I'm sure great polling groups, and I have a lot of respect for them, who keep saying, look, everything progressives want is popular. It's all very popular. In polls, people like it. The problem is, first of all, you've got to, boil that down to voters and make sure that they hear this in their local areas too, not just from pollsters. And the other hand, also they have to obviously show that they can pass some of the stuff. And that's a problem we talked about before. But one thing's very underrated, and I stress this in my book too. People don't learn, I mean, most people still don't learn about their politics, at least learn their politics and start to affiliate with one party or one ideological tendency or another tendency just because they've read about it or they follow people on Twitter or on YouTube or they read somebody's website or another person's website. They do it because of their peers, family members first, their friends in school, people they, you know, have a good time with, you know, people they see at work, you know. Politics is still very personal in that sense, I think. And so, yes, it might be a lot of, you know, independents in Nebraska who like, you know, everything in Build Back Better. But if they're hanging out with people who say, those Democrats are just awful, you know, they're elitist, you know, smug people who want to make us feel guilty about being white, then they're not going to support Democrats, you know. So, you know, I tell young leftists at Georgetown and other places, they say, I spoke to a meeting of DSA people at Georgetown a few months ago, and they say, what's the one thing you tell young leftists at Georgetown to do? And I say, to help the progressive cause, I'd say, move to Nebraska, move to Indiana, move to, you know, Montana, you know, don't stay in areas where there's lots of you. Go out there and organize people, you know, show them that you're not some weird alien force, you know, trying to change America and make it a terrible place. You know, show them that, you know, progressives and Democrats, progressive Democrats, you know, are people who share a lot of the same concerns you have. But you can only do that by being with them, by being in the institutions that they're with. And that's why the decline of labor unions, if I can go on a little bit, is such a key problem for Democrats. Because labor unions used to be that kind of institution. I talk about in the book how West Virginia used to be one of the most democratic states in the country, because United Mine Workers of America taught its members, which were a huge part of the working population in West Virginia, the hardly majority, that Democrats were the party that supported Social Security, supported the right to organize, and that did things for ordinary working people. And so even when Democrats lost presidential elections, they usually carried West Virginia, like in 1988, for example, under Michael Dukakis, nobody's idea of a, you know, populist, you know, working class guy. So that's the problem. Now, if unions can come back, we don't know if they will, Starbucks unionizing is not, you know, a sign unions are coming back in a big way, but that can make a difference as long as the Democrats are able to convince people in those unions that they should vote for Democrats. But I think they can probably do that.
You know, it's interesting. I'm just doing the new New York Times book on the Biden presidency. And it's funny because people always, you know, dunk on Joe Manchin, obviously, but Manchin's experience actually speaks to the story you're telling in West Virginia, because Republicans have asked him for years to become a Republican, you know, and at a key identity level, and this is something that people who don't like Manchin aren't going to be sympathetic to, but at a key identity level, being a Democrat as like the child of Italian immigrants is something that speaks to him. And it's just like, there are these weird, like, and he's, you know, he's a little older, so those dynamics are present, but it's always there. I want to get to, I'm not saying this is a contradiction, but I think it's a difficult dynamic that gets at the problems facing leftists in the Democratic Party, which is that you specifically said that AOC couldn't win in Arkansas. But earlier, so I'm not trying to do a gotcha here, I'm just trying to get at the nuance. You said, because Democrats aren't seen to stand for anything on economic issues, they can't expand the electoral map in a way that'd be effective. Like, they used to win in Arkansas up until the 2000s. So what is it about AOC then? That, because once again, AOC, I think people, obviously she's a leftist on culture issues, but I don't think most voters actually see her primarily through a CRT or LGBTQ rights dynamic. They probably see her through an economic lens. So why is it that the Democrats need to be more economically visionary in your telling, but AOC can't win Arkansas, a state which Democrats used to win in?
Yeah, well, I shouldn't have jumped on AOC. I mean, I think whatever she says, I think she's perceived, you know, as, you know, supporting all those cultural issues that people in Arkansas, not all people, but enough people probably would recoil at, you know. So that's the problem. No, I mean, I think she's a very promising figure, and I'd be curious if she's going to run for state office at some point soon in New York. But of course she's become a firebrand for Republicans. So I just meant, a candidate like her who's perceived as being on the left wing of the Democratic Party, which again is perceived as caring more about what's taught in schools and transgender rights and abortion than about lifting people's incomes and child care credits and so forth. I didn't mean to dump on AOC. I'm a big fan, but then I'm a metropolitan leftist, so I wouldn't.
Yeah, as you're articulating it, it's obvious that was like a sort of cheap shot, because the obvious point is that I think AOC is a talented politician. I think even she personally would perform politics differently if she were from Arkansas.
Sure, sure, of course.
She would not, obviously she's very Bronx and Queens branded. A AOC of Arkansas on a couple of different levels would not perform or even be would even be that way. So, in these last, 5 minutes, I want to just like throw some like quick questions to you. How should this weird thing I've just noticed with leftists is like this real obsession with just labeling, terms like socialist, democratic socialist, always different bits. And I don't think that's an effective political strategy. I don't think that like all of these, it's very, and once again, this is, I'm recording this in Williamsburg. So like, I entirely understand the dynamics you're speaking to. I think at a very like, there's a very hot, cool, hip socialist meetup at a bar near me. So I get the need to brand yourself that way, but that's a little different than performing, capital P or small P politics. So how do you just think about labeling versus just the generic vision-y thing to make it not that eloquent?
Yeah, I say pick a label, go with it, and then talk to people in language they understand. I don't care what the label is. As I said in the beginning of the show, labels keep changing. Liberal used to be a very popular term, and now nobody uses it anymore, except people who don't like those. It's used as pejorative now. So call yourself a leftist or progressive, but, talk about something else, I mean, there's a lot of buzz now, because last night, John Fetterman won in Pennsylvania, and his politics is obviously left, but you wouldn't think about him as a liberal. Somehow liberal is, more people still have this idea of limousine liberals and, people who have a lot of money, who are college professors like me, So the terms get associated with images. So I think being people on the left who are language police are making a big mistake, I think. I don't want to get into all the battles about, what's happening in universities, which is overdone in some ways. But, it's a big mistake to tell people you can't use that word. You have to use that word. Some words you shouldn't use, obviously, because they really inflame. I don't have to go into what those are. But that's not, for the most part, what's going on, when people are policing other people's language. So, choose a term and go with it. Progressive's fine, I don't have any problems with it.
The last question, and this is one which I think relates most to the 60s dynamic you were referencing, was foreign policy. Actually, that's way too big of a question to cover. Do you have like that 3 minutes past the hour?
Sure.
Okay, so I'll do two questions then.
Yeah, school's over, so I'm just working on my new book. So.
Oh, what are you writing about?
I'm writing I want to make Americans care about the labor movement, about unions. I'm doing it in a different way than that. I'm not doing it in a present minded way. I'm a historian. So I'm doing a book about Samuel Gompers, who was the most important labor leader in American history. Most people don't know anything about, but in the context of the rise of the American labor movement in the late 19th, early 20th century, making unions what in many ways the structure they have today. So, it's about the battles labor had before there was any government support for unions, about radicals, leftists opposing Gompers. Gompers himself began as a leftist. Anyway, it's really about the rise of the American labor movement and why it was very necessary at the time, but why it took the form it did.
So then for these last two questions, then, foreign policy. I'm fascinated by left debates about foreign policy post-Ukraine invasion.
Sure.
Because it's very complicated. You know, on the one hand, you know, like the center left, and actually the vast majority of the American people seem deeply okay with the status quo the Biden administration has adopted. The right is becoming increasingly anti that policy. You're seeing this with the vote against the aid to Ukraine. So you see this weird dynamic where I know certain leftists on Twitter will say things like, left, what are you doing? You used to oppose wars in the 2000s, but now you're voting with Biden. The squad voted for the Ukraine aid, and now it's the right who's making this case against it. So in an, you know, bias, like I support the status quo, but how is the left navigating? It's just such a weird dynamic with this, but especially because very clearly, once Biden ruled out, and this is right, this was a good political decision. Once he ruled out NATO US troops on the ground, he put it in a very ambiguous space that would make it difficult to frame this as a pure, you know, U.S. aggression into some type of conflict bit.
Well, as you know, I mean, we're in an unusual time. I saw the other day on YouTube where Noam Chomsky was praising Donald Trump in his stand on Ukraine. When that's happening, we're in a different world here. Noam Chomsky used to say that New York Times is no better than Pravda, you know, in terms of foreign policy, you know, defending the regime, you know. So, yeah, I mean, we have this changed coalitions in foreign policy. On the one hand, you know, you have Biden and other people in mainstream Democrats and Bernie Sanders, too, you know, who are allied, in effect, with the former neoconservatives, you know. Bill Kristol and David Frum and, you know, people who were important in the George W. Bush administration in wanting to support Ukraine. On the other hand, we have the Trump wing of the Republican Party, which is a majority wing. Not all of those people, of course, but a lot of them supporting, you know, in effect, the left position is, you know, NATO's a problem. At least left would like to disband it, but the Trump people don't want to disband it, but they want it to be weak. And a lot of this is debate about liberal internationalism, which goes all the way back to Wilson, you know, if not before, 100 years ago. And for the left, because that's what you asked about, you know, I think it's an important moment, I think, because on the one hand, I think people on the left are right to want to have, you know, a small defense budget, to want you know, the U.S. to do things multinationally, but NATO is a multinational organization, and these countries that want to join NATO are not being forced into it. You know, they really want to be part of NATO because they're afraid of Russian power. So this difficult question about not just Ukraine, but the difficult question about China, you know, there, I think the left is somewhat more united in not wanting to start a new Cold War, you know, recognizes economic, you know, rivalry there, but it's very different from the rivalry with the Soviet Union. I mean, China has tremendous stake in the American economy, as you know. The Russians had, you know, they had a stake in the nesting doll, you know, industry. That's about it, right? during the Cold War. So, you know, I think that's a serious issue. And I the magazine I used to co-edit, Dissent magazine, has a very nice current issue special section on China policy and what's happening in China, which I urge people to read. But I think with Ukraine, most people on the left, I think, would be grudgingly willing to follow, you know, what Bernie Sanders has said, basically, that, yes, we want to cut the defense budget, but Ukrainians are fighting to liberate their country from Russian invaders, from foreign invaders. And any leftist has got to support that, you know. National liberation movements. That's what people like me and Bernie came in on in the 60s in our politics. Yeah. So, you know, I think and the Ukrainians have a much more democratic country than the North Vietnamese did. So, you know, I think it's more of a fringe on the left, which opposes that, actually. But it's an important fringe because there's a deeply seated suspicion of the U.S. ever doing anything right, you know, ever. And I think Americans have to get past that. Leftists have to get past that. We're not in a world anymore where the U.S. is the big hegemon, that it can do whatever it wants. It can overthrow governments in Chile and so forth. You know, we're one of you know, China is approaching America's power. The European community, when it decides to act on its own, can approach America's economic power, certainly. And so we're in a different world, we're in a multipolar world. And it's not the world that a lot of leftists still imagine it is, where U.S. hegemony is evil and has to be opposed whenever it acts, wherever it acts.
Yeah, I was talking to Bhaskar Sunkara in this podcast, and I basically just told him that, like, look, I think that you should acknowledge what happened in Guatemala in the 1950s, but I don't think that that specific case answers any of the questions that are up for grabs right now.
I think
the difficult part here is that you really do just have, basically what I think someone needs to do is someone needs to write an updated version of like Howard Zinn's work for the left, because I think there's a very specific 20th. I just find that the left really tends to struggle with updating 20th century frameworks and applying them to, once again, a more multipolar world. So here's just like the last quick question, which is—
Yeah, can I just add to that?
Please.
Very important. Left is supposed to be in favor of progress, right? Advancing things, learning from history. If you're not learning if you don't learn to adjust your expectations and adjust your analysis when the facts change, then you're not really being a serious leftist. You know, you're continuing to live on old verities. That's not left. That's not what a good left does.
Your words, not mine. Last question then. You said that for many leftists today, like, this is their version of the 1960s and 1960s that you lived. Now, as anyone who knows American history knows, there's a lot of promise, there's a lot of excitement in the 60s. It leads to, there's accomplishment, there are these different bits, but it leads to the 70s backlash. It leads to Ronald Reagan. It leads to America effectively becoming, if not in literal name, like a center-right to conservative country. Bill Clinton says big government is over 30 years later. What is the primary lesson the left should take from the, let's just say, dashed dreams of the 1960s, if you're comparing today's moment to then?
Well, I should say in the 1960s, people like me were a lot crazier than anybody on the left is today.
No one's setting off bombs. Not that you were a bomber, but...
I was a weatherman for a while, Marshall. You know, luckily, I didn't go underground. I wasn't that crazy, but I left weatherman to go to Cuba. Sugarcane with Fidel Castro. So that was my kind of craziness. You know, what the left, I think, should learn, as it's, you know, said before in this hour, is that you've got to be part of a major political party to make gains. You've got to build your own institutions, labor unions, immigrant rights groups, women's groups, grassroots black groups, et cetera, et cetera. But you've got to realize that you're not going to get everything you want. You know, you've got to be part of this coalition, which negotiates with other parts of the coalition to get what you want. But I think then you've got to be able to convince Americans. You can't just mobilize your own side. You got to persuade people. You got to change their minds about issues. And you got to get to them with what you believe. Because a lot of times they don't really know what you think. They never heard what you, they've never spoken to someone like you on the left. I think that those are sort of the general lessons. I believe America can be a much more democratic, egalitarian country. I believe Americans will be happy to be that in that kind of country. A majority would be, I think. But you've got to be a good organizer, not just an activist, a good organizer. And that means convincing people.
Well said. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. The book is What It Took to Win, A History of the Democratic Party. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.